My name is Chris Main. I'm with Rear Admiral K.F. Adams. Today is 30 August 1978, and we're out in Sydney again overlooking the water. We were talking last time off the tape that you'd also won the Greek Cross. What were the circumstances around this decoration?
Yeah, it was the Greek War Cross, give it its full title. The King of Greece was moving from South Africa up to England in one of the Castle liners, and we were sent out to just north of the equator to join him and escort him up to a point where the anti-submarine forces would take him on and escort him into England. And we did this in company with the Queen of Bermuda, which was the other escort. The Queen of Bermuda had been stripped down to become an armed merchant cruiser. And the two ships were provided to escort the King of Greece up. And we ran into frightfully bad weather just before turning him over to the anti-submarine escort. And I regret the Prince David wasn't the seaboat that the others were, and I had to heave her too. And we remained heave to for a day and a night. And thus we got released from the escort and took off back to Halifax. We were in a position then about 50 north, 26 west, I think, by the time we turned him over to the anti-submarine escort. Popular anti-submarine area north of that.
Then what, then this thing came in the mail type thing, or what?
No, it was issued in a official document. Came out and approved by the Canadian government that I was to wear the Greek War Cross for having been of service to the King of Hellenes.
Now, were you were the only one because you were the captain of the ship, or were
others
of your ship's company?
Right.
Or?
No, no, it wasn't. It was just a token payment.
Well, that's great. Also, we were talking, you had a quote on something you wanted to read. It was a forward to a book you were showing.
Oh, yeah. Can I just...
Yeah. The title of this book is...
Let's see. There it is. The Drama of the Graf's Bay and the Battle of the Plate.
Oh, yes.
Compiled by Sir Eugene Millington Drake, who was British minister of Montevideo at the time of the battle.
Was he a KC?
KCMG. And he's put together, it's an extraordinary accurate recount of the Battle of Graf's Bay, of the Drama of the Graf's Bay, and the Battle of the River Plate. Are we recording now?
Yes, we are.
In the preface to this book, I found something that captured my fancy. It, quoting Michael Powell, "It is no disrespect to the qualities of Harwood, Woodhouse, Parry, and Bell, who were the commanding officers involved, to state that when in battle, they made a decision. Nelson Anson and Francis Drake made it for them. The offensive spirit cannot be taught. Captains have at their back 300 years of sea experience and of fighting ships. I couldn't help but remember that little paragraph, because it's so true that the offensive spirit cannot be taught. Captains have at their back 300 years of sea experience in the fighting ships. There's no substitute for experience. I thought that was very touching and very true.
Well, last time we left off, we were still on the on this convoy business going up to Murmansk, is it?
Oh, we were coming back from Murmansk, I believe, weren't we?
Yeah, we just pretty much finished Murmansk. Is there anything, I guess, is there anything that you can think of that would...
I don't think I said that I was very annoyed that the British fleet destroyers were hauled off the convoy about 2 days before we arrived in northern England, and they were told to go to British ports and load with deck loads of ammunition, which always meant bombardment and so on. And as the war was obviously coming very rapidly to a close, we thought that these would be exciting times. I was very annoyed that the three Canadian tribal class were the only destroyers left with the convoy. So I was prepared to express my displeasure on arrival in Scapa Flow 2 days later, when I went in to see Commodore D, who anticipated that I was going to be angry, I think. And he immediately took the wind out of my sails by saying, "I've got some extremely important and very interesting jobs for you Canadians to do." So he took the thunder right out of him. In Iroquois, we were sent down to Rosyth to join the forces that were designed to take Prince Olaf back to Norway. Prince Olaf and the Norwegian government. The two fast mine layers had big hangar spaces where they normally kept the mines, and these ships were made available for all their bags and baggage and records, and there was quite a lot of it. Then the cruiser Devonshire was provided. He was to be in command of the operation. Four destroyers, one of which was to remain there. He was Norwegian manned, and she was to remain in Oslo. And then we had out in front of us 9 minesweepers to sweep us across the North Sea, which was very full of mines at that time. And so it was about the, I imagine, the 10th or 11th of May when we took Prince Olaf on board I think he rode in the Devonshire. Mm-hmm. And we started off for Oslo. It was, we arrived there the day before the national holiday, which was May the 17th. But the passage up the fjord, well, perhaps first I should say that we took on German officers. Each ship took a German officer on board to guide us through minefields around the southern end of Norway. We took on board this young man who spoke very, very poor English, he was not very well received on board. I thought it was a little odd that he should expect to be treated with any respect or anything, but after all, he was a vanquished foe, so I took him into my cabin, and he had his meals with me, and I tried to talk to him. He was very interesting. He was really believed in Hitler. He thought he was a very fine man. And it just shows the brainwashing. I often would like to meet him now to find out just what he thinks of this situation from this day and age. However, they were guided around the minefields into the fjords, the Oslo Fjord, and there were literally hundreds and thousands of small boats that came out from every village along the way, all waving Norwegian flags and shouting, "Welcome to Norway." And we were the first British force to arrive in Oslo after so many years of occupation. On arrival at Oslo, we had to stop the ships. There was no way we could steam through the water. The boats full of gay and happy people were just solid. The whole place was solid, and our speed was reduced to zero. But gradually, small police boats would open up a channel through the boats, and our ships would steam ahead a little bit, and the boats would close in again. It was an extraordinary affair. And eventually, we did get alongside, and the 17th of May arrived. We were invited to by Prince Olaf to attend him on the veranda of the palace. And the 17th of May, traditionally, was a day when all the school children marched past the palace and the king took their salute. It was a very flowery occasion. School children were all decked out in flowers and such. And unfortunately, it rained a little bit that day. And not only did we witness miles and miles and miles of school children, but all the underground decided that they would come through, and they came through dressed in their overalls and carrying machine guns. And it was amazing how many of them there were in Italy, in Norway at that time. So we were required to stand on the porch for not only the 4 hours that it takes for the school children to go by, but an extra couple at the end of that. And I was standing at one end of the porch where the rain was coming in a little bit, and I got half soaked with the rain. And the next day we were free to do as we wished in Oslo, and of course, walking on the streets of Oslo, the children and the people and grown-ups would come to us and ask us for autographs. Just overwhelming. And we couldn't compete with it, but we hope we weren't rude to people when we refused to sign their autograph books.
But you didn't get the Norwegian war cross for standing in the rain.
No.
Well, at this time, there's the VE Day riots in Halifax, is that correct?
They were on May the 8th.
They were on May 8th.
May the 8th.
Now, you were sent right back to Halifax to replace the commandant or the commander of Stadacona, is that correct?
Yes, after a bit, we went from Oslo down to through swept channels. We had as many as 7 pilots to take us just a few miles through the minefields of Skagerrak, and we went down to Copenhagen, where we found the Prince Eugen and the Nuremberg down there, and they're complete with their German crews. And we spent a couple of days taking the ammunition out of these ships. And with their German crews, we escorted them around Denmark and down into Wilhelmshaven, turned them over to the Allies. That was a very interesting trip indeed.
And you were still on the Iroquois at this time?
Yes, yes.
How did it feel to get on the Prince William and that? They were pretty powerful ships, or did you get on them?
No, we just escorted them. We had originally two cruisers and two destroyers in the party, but as we got around the top of Denmark, the cruisers shoved off and went back to England, and the escort duties were myself and the an RN destroyer, Royal Navy destroyer called the Savage, and we took them into Wilhelmshaven. And I must say that I got to know the captain of the Prince Eugen pretty well. He was an extremely capable, fine seaman. He must have been quite a capable naval officer in his day. Had a lot of experience in the Prince Eugen. But we turned them over to the Allies, and as you know, she was eventually taken out to the Pacific, where she became a target of an atomic bomb. And she was blown up there.
We'll have to mention that again when we get back there. After you escorted the Prince Eugen into Wilhelmshaven, you were sent back. What's the story here now? You were sent back to Halifax yourself, or did you hold the whole ship?
No, there were three Canadian travel class destroyers left.
Right.
The Athabascan having been sunk, and we all joined up together. We loaded them up with prisoners of war, and made a very fast passage across the Atlantic to Newfoundland, St. John's, where we oiled and then took off for Halifax.
What prisoners of war?
Well, they were ex-naval and army prisoners.
You mean Canadian prisoners of war, getting them back home, I see.
Canadian prisoners of war who had been released, and we volunteered to take as many as we could.
How did you relate to these fellows who were locked up for a number of years?
How did we relate to them?
Any lasting impressions?
Oh, they were all pretty skinny and worn down, but they were quite happy. They were, I knew a good many of them, and they had spent a pretty quiet time in prisoner of war camp.
Pretty hungry time too, I would imagine.
Yeah, there wasn't, although they didn't complain too much, but I think they looked forward to putting on some weight as soon as they got back to Canada.
Mm-hmm. So you punched her right back to Halifax.
Came right back to Halifax, and
were you leave the command of the Iroquois, or?
No, I my family was in Bermuda, and I got the ship started into a refit, and I took off and went to Montreal, where I got an airplane to fly me. Was going to Bermuda, and so I bummed a ride. I was in Bermuda for about a week, and suddenly I got a telegram saying report back to Halifax as soon as possible. And there were a bunch of Canadian frigates in Bermuda at the time, so I took passage in them, went back to England, back to Halifax, and there, on the way up, I was promoted to captain, confirmed captain, which happened on the 1st of July, at least I think it was the 1st of July, and when I arrived, I was told by the admiral commanding the coast, Admiral G.C. Jones, that I was to take over Stadacona for the second time, and I was with some apprehension. I was looking forward to VE Day, VJ Day now.
Well, they had the VE Day riots.
They had the VE Day riots behind them, and I didn't quite want to
kiss of death type of
appointment. Yeah.
Well, what was the story you got now? What was the inside track on what happened during DE Day that you were told? Because you said before there was quite a problem. The admiral was relieved.
Yes, I think as a result of the Kellogg report, a lot of people were relieved. The admiral and the commanding officer of the Stadacona being two that I remember well.
Do you remember the commanding officer of Stadacona's name at all?
Yeah, I believe his name was Balfour. And I think it was Balfour who was...
It was in this Kellogg report.
Well, this Kellogg report, I think somebody had to be the goat on it. And the Navy was the obvious one to get clobbered. They were there in large numbers, but I don't think that the Navy deserved any greater amount of responsibility than any of the other people that were involved. The great thing to do, of course, was to identify the people who were involved. There were some merchant sailors. Bedford Basin was full of merchant ships, and they weren't going to stay on board their ships on an occasion like VE Day. I think the Army and the Air Force were both represented there. I think there were a considerable number of civilians from every walk of life.
Well, how much real damage was done?
Not much, purely superficial. A few windows were broken. Fur coats were pinched out of them. Some
they raided the liquor
police
store,
cars were turned over on their side, and I think that one streetcar was turned up on its side and set fire to.
Weren't the women soldiers confined to barracks and all this type of thing?
Well, I wasn't there. I'm not too sure what went on. I know that a large number of the people in Halifax were very angry about it. That the town should have been so badly treated. These things are to be expected. It was a very happy day and a very happy occasion for all the sailors, the end of the European War. But who was actually responsible, if anybody was responsible, I couldn't say. I doubt whether any individual could be held responsible.
But they did hold the admiral and the captain.
The Kellogg report was kind of cruel in that regard. But having heard of VE Day and what happened on it, I was forewarned. I certainly didn't want to experience any problems like that for VJ Day. So we organized to throw a party. We opened the barrack gates wide open. People were permitted to come and go. We got 150 volunteers of some nice young men. And the moment that VE Day was declared official, we sent this volunteer body, all booted and spurred, down to protect the liquor stores rather than to beat them up. We formed a kind of a half circle. I thought that would create a good impression with the Alagoans.
The first thing was to protect the liquor store.
We formed a kind of a semicircle around them.
These would be all serving sailors, is that correct?
Yes, yeah. They were all volunteers. They volunteered for the duty. And in order to keep the rest of them, there were some thousands on board, we just threw a party. We had plenty of beer, all paid for by the canteen funds. It was the sailors' own money. And we managed to get a good stock of beer on board in the wet canteens and elsewhere. And we split the band into two sections, one a rousing, marching band to keep them amused on the roads and the sidewalks, and the other into a dance orchestra, which for those that wanted to dance, music would be provided in the gymnasium. We had a movie theater on board, and we kept that running at full speed for anybody. As they got tired of party, they could always go to the movie theater and sleep. I always remember we had a picture called From Pillow to Post showing. And the next week, that same film was to be shown at the Capitol Theater. And one of our men reported later that he had gone with his girlfriend, and he said, "Oh, I've seen this picture." And within the hearing of the manager, who complained bitterly to Stadacona that his business was being interfered with, little did he know that we probably saved his whole theater.
At the day of VEC Day.
But it was a failure to recognize what we were doing and in the Navy. I think the Navy was very maligned by individuals of Halifax population. Some were very bitter about it. And I suppose some had reason, but I think that had those same people done more during the war in support of sailors, there probably wouldn't have been the same vicious attack that on VE Day that there was.
Are you saying then that not that there's any excuse for malicious damage and vandalism, but that Halifax, well, some of the people in Halifax weren't as kind or as considerate or as helping as they should have been, or what's?
Well, I think this is true of anywhere. Halifax, a good deal of sympathy with Halifax. They've always been a naval port, but
they have nothing else.
The naval port was always small in pre-war time, and suddenly it became a huge naval port with an influx of sailors, dockyard workers, and everybody else. Army and Air Force were using it to a very large extent. Transports loaded there for Halifax, from Halifax to the other side. And Halifax had a tremendous expansion, and it wasn't prepared for this expansion, I don't think.
How were relations after your VJ Day success? Did they improve at all?
Yes, they did. I remember one occasion I went to buy a watch for my daughter, whose birthday it was, and the people who were at the store paid me no attention at all because I was in uniform. And so I got quite angry and I rattled the top of the desk, and I guess they feared that I was going to break the glass top of it. And I announced to the young lady behind the counter, I said, "I had nothing to do with the riots here in VE Day. I was away in England fighting your war for you. And now I want to buy something, and I don't see why I should be treated like a second-hand citizen." And she apologized, and we got on with it, and I bought the watch. But I was so impressed with that I got the president of the Retail Merchants Association to come and see me. And we had a good many words about it, and it became known throughout the Retail Merchants that the Navy was not going to put up with this kind of thing, and the Navy was not pleased, and that they issued a directive that anybody who treated any customer without respect due to them, that would entail instant dismissal. So things improved a little bit in the shops and so on. But things were in a pretty tough situation. The Navy wasn't very popular in Halifax. And of course we still had, we couldn't discharge, there was no discharges going through. We had Navy at full strength because V-Day hadn't been, or VJ-Day had not arrived. But once VJ-Day was over, we were very busy running people through the mill to get them discharged and get them back. And
this
most people wanted
what,
to go.
Until about Christmas? Took about 6 months to turn it down? Or?
No, I think it was done decidedly before that.
Much before Christmas?
Yeah, I think we took about probably 3 months, and the personnel pictures pretty well cleaned up in 3 months.
August, September, October, that's November. Yeah, that's very good.
Yeah, the Chief of Naval Staff, I remember, gave a directive that there was no sense hanging on to people when they
pay them.
When they wanted to go.
What was the change like now? I mean, now you were at Stadico in the height of the war, when I gather money was not really a problem or a concern, and now we're back to the good old days of peace.
Well, we didn't.
Did it turn off the tap, or did you realize it?
No, I was never conscious of the tap being turned off. Quite the reverse. I think we'd sold pretty generally across the country. The Navy was a good thing, and a sizable Navy would remain in force, and then never again would we go back to the doldrums where we had been before the war.
Boat in each ocean?
Yes, we had two cruisers, you see, and they were required a lot of men, a lot of money to run them. And then we had the travel class destroyers, and of course we were thinking ahead already to the planning of the new ships to come into force, the ones that are now 30 years old.
Old, yeah.
The Celeron class and the Vespuce class and so on. But they were beautiful ships when they came out.
Looking a little tatty now.
Yeah, they were called the Cadillacs by the Americans and the British. The Cadillacs of the anti-submarine fleet. They were terrific ships when they first came out.
Doesn't it bother you at all that there seems to be, well, this disregard and just left the ships the way they were for this long time, and though they've improved the technicals inside and everything, still the ship's 30 years old. She's 30 years old.
Well, I think it's very unfortunate that ships just cost so much money. They're very expensive and very toys. I think that any Navy must be kept modern. We always used to say that the moment we got a ship, she was obsolete the moment she became operational,
mm-hmm.
Because of all the new plans and everything, but that's the way we must work and so on. I think it would be most unfortunate if they don't go ahead with this shipbuilding program, regardless of what it costs. It's money well invested.
Well, seeing that this thing's going to probably have to stick around for another 30 years.
Yes, but provided they keep modernizing equipment and so on, they can be pretty well maintained.
I was wondering, we have the first business of unification in 46, of one minister, this type of thing. But let me hang on to that question for a moment. I was wondering, what about reversion day or whatever they called it. Now I know that these 30-year-old brigadiers going back down to lieutenant colonels and 25-year-old group captains and this kind of business being reverting down in rank. Now the Navy wasn't as eager in that sense. Did you notice much reversion at all, or if any?
No, none at all.
None at all?
None at all. The only reversion was in the cases of volunteer reserve officers who transferred to the regular force afterwards. And I think it was very seldom, but I also think I'm aware of a couple of cases where they had been promoted to commander and they transferred in the rank of lieutenant commander or something like that, and there was a slight loss. But as far as the regular force concerned, our promotions had been never
generous. They weren't inflated.
No, they weren't inflated. Age for age, we compared with the Royal Navy. Of course, we always had to bear in mind that whenever we sent a ship to sea, his seniority would be recognized by the ships of the Royal Navy that he met at sea, and therefore he must be of sufficient age and sufficient experience to take his command, if necessary, depending on seniority. And we were always very conscious of that, so we went along hand in hand with the Royal Navy, and we never put people in ships with exaggerated.
You didn't have 25-year-old captains, in other words?
Oh, no, no. No, we never had any captains who under 40 at all.
What about unification, the business of appointing Claxton as a single Minister of National Defense? Now it's towards the end of 1946, it's December 46. But the whole idea of adopting a unified defense program and closer coordination, this type of stuff. What was your feeling towards it? The only way to go? Or?
Yes, I did. Of course, before the war, we had only one Minister of National Defense. And during the war, it broke into three because each and everyone became so large and so so many people involved that they went in for, they had three ministers. But it didn't alarm me in the slightest to see them go back to one minister. Although I must say that Angus L. MacDonald was very good to the Navy when he was naval minister. He being a Nova Scotian was very good to the Navy. But Brooke Claxton was a capable man, and I think he was very fair to all three services. So it didn't alarm me to see it.
We're jumping ahead now here, but how did you feel about the consolidation of the three services into the Canadian forces now that we have today?
Well, of course, I can't help but think it was a mistake. I think that unification was the wrong thing. Integration, I would approve of. I don't see that it's necessary to spend money on the armed forces unnecessarily, but to combine every function of the three services and make them unify the services was, in my opinion, I didn't ever think it would work, nor do I believe it has worked. Originally, I took the attitude that it would be for the young men to decide whether it would work or not. It was not up to we older people looking backwards on the thing to decide whether it was a good thing or not. But as I talk to some of them nowadays, I believe it hasn't worked. Of course, in my opinion, there are two ingredients which are absolutely essential in the maintenance of any armed forces. One is morale and the other is discipline. And without either, or without both, the unit cannot be successful. And I'm not sure that there is sufficient discipline and therefore sufficient morale in the armed forces as they are now. I was a great believer in what was represented by Landymore, Admiral Landymore. I think I was very largely responsible for bringing him up as a cadet and later as a gunnery officer. He served as a gunnery officer under my command. And I knew him pretty well, and I have great respect for his opinion. And I think he fought a valiant but losing battle. And I was very much in support of him during his time of when he fought this thing.
Landymore was hailed as a pretty courageous guy when he went out.
Oh, yes, yes. He was in command of the Atlantic coast. And his cry was, just as I said, unification never.
I guess we should back up to where we were. You were at Stadacona. How long did you remain there? You started in July 45. You went to carriers or something, didn't you?
No, I came out here to this coast after, I was in Stadacona for a little over a year, and until about June 1946, and I stayed in Stadacona during the letting down period, mm-hmm. and consolidation of the schools, and of course as soon as we let down to bedrock, where we started to build up again, because we started in recruiting for the regular force. And that took quite a bit of organization and changes in the direction we were going. We had previously trained people overnight, but now we had, going back into the regular force, we had to be more thorough in the basic training and more meticulous all the way through,
and so on.
Mm-hmm. And so it meant a considerable change in our plans of training. In June 1946, I was appointed to command the cruiser Uganda, which was out here. Uganda had been to the Pacific and took part in several battles in the Pacific under command of Captain Rollo Mingy, who was later Vice Admiral.
And he lives up island here.
Lives up at Qualicum.
That's right.
Uganda only had three captains. He had one Royal Navy captain who became a Vice Admiral Andrews. And he was in command of her when she got a bomb down through her at Salerno in Italy. And knocked three propeller shafts out of her, and she only had one left, but she steamed at 14 knots across the Atlantic to Charleston, South Carolina, where she was refitted. And during her refit, she was sold by the Royal Navy to Canada. And Rollo Mingy went down to take command of her.
They changed the name, didn't they?
Not until after the war. Her name was never changed to, we wanted to call her the Quebec, being a more or less a sister ship to the Ontario. Yes. The Protectorate of Uganda asked particularly that we should retain the name of Uganda until at least the end of the war.
So just and reverted from HMS, it just went HMCS?
She became HMCS Uganda.
Mm-hmm.
And I joined her out on this coast in June 46 and commanded her during 46 and 47. And our main duty during that time was to train ordinary seamen, teach people to live on ship.
But you're on a monster ship. This is a cruiser. This isn't.
This is a cruiser. 500
destroyer kind.
No.
Yeah.
Much bigger than that. She was 555 feet long, and she displaced about 12,000 tons.
Now this is a change. Now in that part of your early education, not all of it, because of circumstances beyond your control, was to go over to England and to get your experience on the, what was the Devonshire, was it the Devonshire, was a, or and whatever the name of the word, there were a couple of cruisers that were strictly cadet cruiser, classroom come, cruiser come.
Yeah, those were cadet classes, yes.
Cadet classes. But now in 47, we're starting to stop sending people over to England for this midshipman type training and getting them into our own cruisers.
Yes, that's right, we're running our own schools. We developed during the war our ability to handle our own schools. And,
this is a very significant point, I think, because how did it feel to be on part of that, that you were now replacing Greenwich, Nelson, Drake, as you said there?
Well, it felt good, you know, to be the more we can do in Canada, but without severing that almighty tie with England, which I think is most important. It's great to feel that you've got this 300 years of background by adoption.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a great believer in tradition and so on. And I think it's a dreadful thing to feel that you've lost anything. There's no need to lose it. No need to lose it at all. I'm very much in favor of an exchange of officers from Canadian service to the Royal Navy. And maybe some of that tradition of Nelson, Drake, and Anson would rub off on some of our Canadians. I see no harm in it.
So in 47, you commanded this mammoth ship. Well, this must have been quite something. Now you had the Prince David to look back on, and these other vessels. Now you're commanding one of the most powerful ships afloat, I would imagine. The cruiser, most powerful ship.
Well, she's hardly a battleship, but she.
Okay, it isn't the Missouri, but would it be the same type class as, say, the Belfast?
Yes, yeah, very similar to the Belfast. She was county class, whereas the Belfast was what they call the city class, named after